Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A recent New York Times investigation explores the world of the multi-billion dollar private equity industry and their growing influence on our daily lives. Since the 2008 financial crisis, private equity firms have taken over crucial services like water supplies, ambulance companies, fire departments, transportation, garbage collection, and a lot more. The reporters for the New York Times, including today's guest, Ben Protest, report that private equity put a unique stamp on these businesses. Unlike other for-profit companies, which often have years of experience making a product or offering a service, private equity is primarily skilled in making money. And in many of these businesses, private equity firms applied a sophisticated money-making playbook, a mix of cost cuts, price increases, lobbying, and litigation. In emergency care and firefighting, this approach creates a fundamental tension, the push to turn a profit while caring for people in their most vulnerable moments. For governments and their citizens, the effects have often been dire. In at least two cases, lawsuits contend poor service led to patient deaths. So who are the biggest players in the private equity market? How did they gain so much power? And why isn't this issue getting more attention? Today, we are joined by Ben Protest, an investigative business reporter with the New York Times and one of the reporters investigating the rise of private equity firms. And you can see the package of stories at yourcallradio.org. And Ben joins us from New York. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Congratulations on this investigation. How did you and your colleagues first learn that private equity firms were taking over such crucial social services?
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, you know, it's in, you know, the 911 we dial. It's in what we purchase in for our bathrooms. You know, it's what we turn on the tap of water when we get up in the morning. It's literally from start to finish our day. And you kind of just wonder who's involved in all these different activities. And we just kept keeping coming back to the same answer, that it's private equity.
Well, before we dive in and learn about your findings, let's talk about private equity firms. We learned a little bit about them when Mitt Romney was running for president because of Bain Capital, but you don't really hear much about private equity firms. So tell us a bit about them and how they operate.
Well, right now it's a $4.3 trillion industry, and that's just tremendous growth since the financial crisis. So we're talking more than the value of Germany's GDP here, $4.3 trillion. So, you know, you're managing assets for everyone from pension funds to, you know, big sovereign wealth funds to various other institutions and institutional investors, and you're making it work. So you're buying companies. Sometimes you're taking them over through leverage buyouts, you know, using debt. And sometimes you're actually just taking over an actual resource. So it's not just the company, but it's you're buying out, you know, you're buying out a government's water rights, or you're buying out a government's, you know, 911 responsibilities. And so basically imagine them as private investors, have a tremendous amount of money and capital at their disposal that also have increasingly in the last few years a tremendous amount of power.
And what changed for private equity firms after the 2008 financial crisis?
I would say two main things. One is that after the crisis, we've seen banks forced to pull back from many different things. So, you know, there's the Dodd-Frank Act, which was enacted after the financial crisis, that really was meant to rein in risk-taking at the big banks. And to a certain extent, I think it's been successful in that regard. You know, and the result, though, is that risk doesn't just disappear on Wall Street. It goes somewhere else. And so, you know, regulators describe it as kind of like a game of whack-a-mole, right? You knock it down out of the banks and it pops up somewhere else. Well, that somewhere else has been private equity. So I think there's been this, you know, pulling back by other Wall Street institutions, and private equity really sought to fill a void. In some ways, it's been a, you know, a helpful service that some of these firms have provided, because there was a void. So particularly in the mortgage industry, that's been the case. But when you pile into one of these industries and you don't have the same expertise and you have a shorter investment horizon, or you just have a, you have to meet the demands of your investors, who in some cases expect 15, 20, 25% returns, there is going to be some kind of collateral consequence of that.
Are they regulated at all?
There is some regulation, for sure. So the SEC does have oversight and exam authority over the largest private equity firms, and they have to fill out various forms and are tracked. Certainly, they're less regulated than other Wall Street institutions, in particular the banks.
And would any of the names sound familiar to us? Any of the executives sound familiar to us?
That's what's so great about the industry from a business model perspective and from a messaging perspective is probably not, unless you're a business reporter or someone who kind of is very engaged in Wall Street affairs. You know, the names like Fortress Investment Group or Warburg Pincus or KKR, Blackstone, these are not necessarily household names, unlike a J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America or Citi. Those are names that we've kind of come to really recognize because they're on our street corners. They have branches. In the case of private equity, you know, they're typically in office towers in Midtown Manhattan, and get, you know, their name is not on the outside of the building. So I think it's a much more anonymous existence, but that doesn't mean less powerful. In fact, you know, in some cases, more powerful than the banks increasingly over time. And obviously, the banks themselves cause some of these problems. So there's a real natural progression here. But the question is, okay, so now that there's this shift in responsibility and risk and oversight and power, how has that transition happened? In some cases, it has not happened that well.
It's amazing to think that these private equity firms are now running fire departments, ambulance centers, transportation, water supplies. How does this happen? Can you explain the process? How is a private equity firm able to take over a local fire department, for example?
So, sure. Basically, in a lot of instances, what you have is, you know, budget cuts. And so, certainly there's an issue of, you know, a need of a void that's been being filled. And I think a lot of times the, dynamic that's driving that need is municipal budget cuts. So if you're a local town that does not have the resources to pay for something like ambulance services, then you might really benefit from having a private institution provide that service. There are several private ambulance companies that do exist, fewer on the firefighting side. It's much more on the ambulance side. And then increasingly what we've seen is that private equity has come in and bought out those private companies. So even if those private companies have existed for decades and that need has existed for decades, increasingly we see private equity see that as a good investment.
Is this mainly happening in poor and low-income areas?
And I would say add rural to that, too, so
okay.
Especially in the fire space. So what we've seen is that this one company, Rural Metro, that has existed as actually started as a private fire department in the 1940s, really was there to fill a gap that in unincorporated land. So these are areas that just don't have the same level of kind of government resources, and really there's kind of almost a gap. So, you know, that the benefit to the taxpayers, you're not paying as many, you know, taxes every quarter, every year. And so, you know, kind of that creates this, opportunity to provide a fire service that was, you know, private, which really kind of began as almost a philanthropic endeavor in the 1940s. And then over time, they became a public company in the 90s, and that became to, you know, a little bit less of a philanthropic mission. And then it was sold to private equity in 2012, and that's kind of, 11, and that's really when it kind of took off as a, you know, where their problems really increased in the last few years.
Ben, you and your New York Times colleagues quote Michelle Wild Anderson in your piece. She's a law professor at Stanford who specializes in state and local government. And she told you, quote, "We're reaching new lows in the public safety services we will help provide, especially in very poor cities. Private equity firms are not philanthropists," end quote. So is this happening because we have seen decades of tax cuts and then all you have these local budgets that are completely starved? And as a result, they're not able to fund social services. So then in walks the private equity firm to basically save the day and say, well, you have a volunteer fire department, or you don't have the ambulance services that you need, so we're going to provide it for you.
I think that's one of the aspects of it for sure. I think another aspect is that it's not just the tax cuts, I would say, but also the pension obligations that a lot of these municipal governments have. It's a tremendous amount, tremendous burden, really, to fund all the pensions fully for all the firefighters and all the paramedics and EMTs. And so, you know, if you're a local government and you're thinking, geez, I have an option here to potentially, I'm taxed, I'm really resource constrained, I have an option to use a private service, you know, maybe that's actually the best thing for the public, the best thing for my taxpayers.
Today we're speaking with Ben Protess, an investigative business reporter with the New York Times, one of the reporters investigating the rise of private equity firms. And you can find their package of stories at yourcallradio.org. They've got one piece that's great. It's very interactive. It shows how you interact with private equity firms on a regular basis. Everything from fire departments, ambulance centers, transportation, water, schools. And Ben, is any of this happening in California? Because most of the pieces that I read are focused on cities outside of California.
Well, certainly in the West, there's a lot of concentration in Arizona because you have a lot of unincorporated land there. But absolutely in California, you have the mortgage side of things. So we've talked a lot about the ambulance and firefighting, but one whole business area that you've seen a lot of investment from private equity has been in the housing market. And so, you know, you've seen that could be in rental housing, it could be in the mortgage industry, and there's a big, opportunity in California, as we saw, in the lead up to the financial crisis. You know, there's a lot of, there were a lot of issues there at that time, and certainly kind of what we've seen is this private equity kind of, steps in into this role. In some cases, they brought, crucial resources, and in some cases, they've actually repeated some of the mistakes that the banks made. And that is not, unique to California. That's across the country.
Right. We've done a little bit of reporting on this. Blackstone now owns the largest number of single-family rentals, and they bought up all of these foreclosed homes, and now so many are owned by a private equity firm.
That's absolutely right. So Blackstone is arguably the largest private equity firm in the country, if not the world, and they have a tremendous amount of resources, and they're very sophisticated, and they actually do things very well, especially relative to some of their peers. The issue, I think, what we discovered with them is that in what they did very wisely from a business perspective is they targeted a lot of areas that were probably going to bounce back from the financial crisis. So, certain areas of Florida, areas that are outside of major cities, suburbs that were hard hit by the financial crisis. But they realized, people are going to either find new jobs or they're going to keep their jobs, and people's homes are underwater, but that's going to be temporary. And so if we just hang on to these properties for a little bit, we're going to see a tremendous need for rental housing. And sure enough, they're right. They're making tremendous amounts of money and very doing very well for their investors based on that strategy. The challenge is that when you have all this money coming into those areas, and there's good that comes with that, you're not seeing them invest in inner cities. Hmm. You're not seeing them invest in, Oakland, somewhere where maybe there would be kind of, change that's happening in the neighborhood that could be kind of improving, but always benefits from Wall Street money kind of rehabilitating some of these properties. And you just don't see that kind of in the same level as, some of these other private institutions that have invested. And so there's this kind of this question of, like, some of the people hardest hit by the financial crisis, are they benefiting from the recovery? And the answer is almost certainly not.
Right. In 2013, Bloomberg had a good story about Blackstone spending $100 million a week on properties in California,
absolutely,
Arizona, Florida, and Nevada.
Absolutely. They bought up all these properties on the cheap, and again, to their credit, you do hear the occasional complaint about the properties, just like very few people love their landlord. I think that's across the board. But really, you don't hear that much with Blackstone relative to the others. The issue you hear is, like, I can't afford the rent.
Right.
It's so high, or it's not in my neighborhood. And, Blackstone does very little Section 8 housing, and they would probably do more if they were in other areas that, kind of you saw some of these people who want to, typically Section 8 voucher holders want to stay somewhat close to their families, and you just don't see necessarily Blackstone investing in the same level as others. And so I think that's kind of the question is, if really, and the federal government has been supporting a lot of this by selling a lot of these properties at major discounts, the question becomes, do you have the benefit of these benefits from the federal government, and you're buying these properties on the cheap, and then perhaps you're not investing in certain areas that really could use it? Now, of course, they're a business. They have shareholders and they have investors. That's who they owe the responsibility to. But the question is, does the end user, does the person who's actually living in these properties benefit?
And as Ben said, the private equity firm is a 4.3 $1 trillion industry. Investors expect a 15% to 25% return. If you have any questions for Ben about his reporting, if you read about this, you learn that private equity firms are now taking over ambulance centers, fire departments, water systems, transportation, garbage collection. What are your thoughts about this? If you know that your city has contracted out a service to private equity firms, if you work for local government, what do you think about this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Ben, when I read all of these articles, I have so many highlights because so much stood out. As someone who spent, how long did you all work on this? I mean, it must have been months.
Too long for our editors, I think, yeah. We did take quite a while. We've been working off and on for about 2 years.
2 years, wow.
And more exclusively kind of just on this aspect of it the last, like, 9 months or so. So, you know, news business being what it is, you got to keep doing it and keep doing your daily responsibilities. And you know, up until the last few months, we've continued to kind of cover our normal beats. But the last few months, we've done this pretty much exclusively.
So there's so many things that stand out. What really stood out for you doing this reporting?
You know, what's so interesting is just kind of the omnipresence of the industry. And this isn't necessarily a bad thing. This is just kind of, you know, and I think you mentioned the graphic, and what the graphic captures is, it's, you know, kind of a day in the life of private equity. And, you know, it's from the moment you wake up and you turn on the tap, you know, and get a glass of water to, you know, you go to your office building. Well, guess what? Blackstone doesn't just invest in rental properties. They're a major landlord of commercial property. So guess there's a chance that your office building is owned by private equity or Blackstone in particular. And so, you know, it's just how present they are in our lives in a way that we don't know or appreciate. It's really something that kind of stood out to us in a way that we didn't expect, just how present they were.
Blackstone also owns SeaWorld. I mean, they have their hands in so many different industries.
Right, and I think that the framework for our series is, like, you know, certainly private equity, you know, has been a specialist in buying private companies. So that could be in healthcare, that could be, you know, they've been in nursing homes before, they've been in amusement parks. You mentioned SeaWorld, and clothing. That's not totally, certainly it's very present in our lives, but it's not totally new. The thing that struck us as so new is there's these two functions that used to be performed by either banks or by governments,
right.
And we're seeing them kind of step in areas that, you know, and you know your bank, they're accountable to you in a way that you can, you know, pull out, you can close your checking account, you can, you know who they are, they're visible to you. Same with your government, you can vote with your feet, you know, you can either move or you can, you know, vote against the person who's your elected official. In the case of private equity, there's just not that same level of accountability.
Well, we have a related question from a caller. Let's go to Ryan in San Francisco. Hi, Ryan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my question. Yeah, my question really was, I mean, PE firms employ highly educated, highly motivated professionals. I mean, isn't it actually a good thing that they would take over these, you know, fire departments, ambulance centers, et cetera, in governments and cities? Because you can never imagine that a government entity will ever run things efficiently. So
ever?
So net-net, it's a good thing for the economy.
You can't ever imagine that a government would run anything efficiently?
Yeah, because it doesn't attract the most educated people, like a PE firm.
So many good people work in government. I have to stick up for people who work in government. I mean, we're talking about teachers, firefighters. I mean, so many good people work in government. But Ben, what would you say? I'm sure a lot of people would say that private equity firms might run things more efficiently than government.
Absolutely. And I think the question is, what is the cost of that efficiency? So I think one of the things we documented in our story is that the efficiencies meant job losses or cuts to the pension funds of the firefighters, and in fact freezing outright of the pension fund in the Phoenix area. And so I think the question becomes is, as they develop these efficiencies, and by the way, that's probably a really good thing, and caller's absolutely right, that these are highly educated, very competent people, and you know, not to paint a broad brush here, but often, a lot of times, good people who care about doing the right thing, the problem is they have to answer to their investors. They have a fiduciary duty to turn out these 15, 20, 25% returns, and in doing that, it has to come from somewhere. So they're going to cut. They're either going to cut jobs, or they're going to invest in certain other areas that maybe are a little more aggressive. So we saw them invest in bill collection, for instance, and so we saw a lot of aggressive billing where they created these programs like something called Care to Cash, which is a program where in the ambulance space, you tend to think in ambulance it should just be care, but it's Care to Cash. And so certainly, you know, they need to get paid, they deserve to get paid, but they tried these different documentation techniques where they kind of would stick bills or paperwork in front of people who were lying on a stretcher and, you know, maybe were not in the best state of mind. And we've talked to several employees who were like, we couldn't do this. This is unethical for us to do it. And they refused to do it. And so I think efficiencies can be a really good thing, and the caller is absolutely right that the education and experience brought to this is important, but it does come at some expense, and the question here was how great an expense, and I think we saw that the expense came at, with just the average consumers and the average people who were served by these, and the employees, by the way, as well.
Ryan, are you still with us?
Yeah, I am.
So I had to just push back on that just because so many people dedicate their lives to serving the public. I mean, they're doing good work in a really, in some cases, difficult situation where they have maybe low pay, a lot of bureaucracy. But, I mean, what are your thoughts about that? These people are actually, they have to answer to the public, not investors who expect a 15 to 25% return.
Yeah, I mean, but you see, my thought is you can't have it both ways, right? We live in the mecca of capitalism. The thesis of capitalism is around efficiency and return on equity and return on capital.
At what cost? People die because the ambulance... But at what cost? People are dying because the ambulance doesn't arrive on time. The drugs in the ambulance are outdated. They don't have enough equipment because it's all about the bottom line.
And I would just one other point on the pursuit of the bottom line also makes sense, good sense. Here's the challenge. We use data from S&P Capital IQ, and they ran data for us for all the private ambulance companies that are in their database. You're talking about 1,200 ambulance companies. 12 ambulance companies were run by private equity in the recent past. 3 of those 12 have gone into bankruptcy. So not a lot of, maybe perhaps too many efficiencies were created. And in the rest of the realm, so the rest of the roughly 1,200, 0 went into bankruptcy, so the non-private equity owned. So you can have a privately run institution, and perhaps they even do it better than government. But when you have 3 out of 12 bankruptcies, it's not a great hit rate.
Can you also talk more about what you found just in terms of how profit really affects these services? And, you know, how did we get to a point in this country where we don't really have expectations anymore of what government can provide when it comes to just basic services, whether you call the fire department, whether you're sick and you call an ambulance to come help you?
Well, I think that, you know, part of this is years of trouble where people, came to expect a certain level of service, and even in the government, they weren't going to get that level of service. But when we kind of tracked over, the time period in which private equity was in a couple of these companies, in particular Rural Metro, which I mentioned earlier, you saw the response times in certain areas really not improved, in fact worsen, and the fines and penalties for that going up. And so you don't, you came to expect a certain level of service, but even if you weren't getting it, you relied because your government was accountable to you. Here, you had a private company that was owned and operated by a private equity firm, and at the end of the day, if the service wasn't getting better, who do you have to complain to?
You report that TransCare EMS is controlled by the firm Patriarch Partners. They filed for bankruptcy. One day, cities and towns up and down the East Coast had TransCare services. The next day, they didn't. Richard Thomas, the mayor of Mount Vernon, New York, which relied on TransCare, said private equity has, in this case, threatened public safety. He says it's not the way to treat the public. Patriarch's owner and founder, Lynn Tilton, said in a statement that she was saddened by the unfortunate circumstances that triggered the end of TransCare's operations and the heartache that it had caused. But she noted TransCare, like other ambulance companies, faced the obstacles inherent to its business model. So what's now happening in Mount Vernon, New York?
So they ended up using another private provider, and the difference is they used to use TransCare, which they gave them the exclusive right to operate. TransCare, the exclusive right to operate in their area. So they didn't need to be paid. The government did not need to pay them because the contract itself was the freedom to operate in that town. Now they've had to pay out of their own taxpayer dollars for a new private company to come forward, which maybe is a better model. It's unclear. We'll have to see. But when I talked to the mayor said, you know, we have to really consider another option here. Should the government go back to providing the service? They were very unhappy and disappointed in kind of how it worked out with TransCare because they were left holding the bag, and they had at the last second, they had to bring in a new company and pay for this new company. And so now they've been considering the last few months, can they themselves create their own ambulance, you know, department within perhaps their public safety, within their fire department? And this is something that the last I talked to him, they were still exploring.
And again, this brings up just the role of government and what the public expects from the government, and we're planning to do a show about that soon. Today we're joined by Ben Protest, an investigative business reporter with the New York Times, one of the reporters investigating the rise of private equity firms, which now control a lot of what you do in your daily life, whether it's drive, drink water, call the ambulance, call the fire department, put your trash out. What are your thoughts on private equity firms controlling these services that were once conducted by the government? If you work for local government, what are your thoughts about this? As Ben and his colleagues report, the private equity industry is a $4.3 trillion industry, and investors expect a 15 to 25% return. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org, leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the history and experiences of people with disabilities and how that should be taught in California schools. Last month, California announced a new framework for teaching more inclusive history, and this includes the history of people with disabilities. This is often missing from students' lessons, or it's framed in a charity or medical model. So what would a more empowering and inspiring disability curriculum look like? That is tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we're going to speak with David Diane, a great reporter who's out with a new book about three people who tried to blow the whistle on what really happened with the housing crisis. It's kind of connected to what we're talking about today with Ben Protest. He's an investigative business reporter with the New York Times. He and his colleagues have an explosive investigation about the rise of private equity firms. This is a $4.3 trillion industry. Investors expect a 15 to 25% return. And now these firms have taken over very crucial services like water supplies, ambulance companies, fire departments, transportation, garbage collection, and more. And if you have any questions for Ben about what they found, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about private equity firms now taking over social services and providing these services for the public when profit is really what many of them care most about? Do you think it's possible to do both, provide a social service and make a massive profit, 15 to 25%? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you if you work for private equity or a local government. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ben, let's talk a little bit about Fortress Investment Group. This is one of Wall Street's most powerful private equity firms. Tell us about Fortress.
Fortress fortresses and everything. So if there is a way to kind of think of fortress, it's kind of the encapsulation of our entire series. They're a huge player in the housing market. They're a huge player in infrastructure in the sense that they're building the nation's only private interstate railroad right now in Florida. They're a big player in kind of various other aspects, but in consumer credit, like subprime loans, things like that. So they're everywhere. And the focus of our story on Fortress, which was the third installment of our series, was really focused on how private equity is quite influential in state capitals. And so they're not in a present way. It's not like, you know, you send the private equity executive down to the state house, although that does happen occasionally. It's much more that they do the influencing through their companies, through the companies they own. So Fortress owns this company named Springleaf Financial, also now known as OneMain. It's the largest subprime installment lender in the country. And what we've seen them do is across the country, they've gone from state house to state house and essentially writing new legislation. So, you know, sometimes you think, you know, okay, I see in my state house the law has changed. Well, you might assume that your state lawmaker, your elected representative, wrote that legislation, but oftentimes it's not. It's a corporate lobbyist who's written that, and the legislator basically just puts his or her stamp of approval on it. In this case, we obtained emails through public records requests really documenting the process by which Fortress's company, Springleaf, went through and capital to capital and changed the law and basically raised costs on consumers. And the ultimate impact is on, you know, the average, you know, every time the bill came every month, you know, they were able to basically extract more and more from consumers because of this lobbying.
You also write about Fortress building a passenger railroad line
right.
in Florida that promises to get people from Miami to Orlando faster. The line plans to run 32 trains a day, making 4 stops altogether. And you report that in Florida, where Fortress is building this railroad, the firm took advantage of revolving door politics, political aides becoming lobbyists and vice versa. When an advisor to the government moved into the private sector, he advocated for the train project and then returned to the governor's office as chief of staff. I feel like we need to have a graphic to follow the lines there. But what did you learn about the revolving door and Fortress?
It's funny. Sometimes it's just old-fashioned lobbying of writing legislation, and you know, you can just present your bill, and that worked for them with one of their companies. In another company, one thing that worked was this revolving door, which is essentially, you know, you have the guy, you know, who worked for the governor's office, then left and went to work for the train company that Fortress owned, and then after he lobbied, kind of advocated for that project, just went back to the governor's office. In a very short period of time. So a very quick trip. And so it's what they call it, this revolving door. And I think that, you know, the benefit that came to them from this, they would say it was no benefit and they didn't need this guy and he was kind of freelancing. He was just doing what he could to try to help his colleagues. But what we were able to identify from government records is that he was sitting there texting with the governor's aides and setting up meetings for Fortress executives, and he was present in at least one of these meetings. So if he really wasn't that helpful, I'm not quite clear why he was in all of these meetings and various planning stages. But I think the idea is that partly what makes you influential in state capital is access to power. And if you are accessible to power because you used to work for the person in power, then that just makes you even more valuable in the private sector.
And you're talking about Governor Rick Scott of Florida?
That's right.
So I think this is a fascinating story. And so this is a project called All Aboard Florida, and it is the nation's only purely private intercity passenger railroad. It's expected to take 5 years and cost about $3 billion. Speeds reaching 100 miles an hour. A lot of people are hoping for this kind of transportation in the United States. So talk a little bit about what went on behind the scenes to ultimately approve this project, because, you know, we have a lot of government officials who don't want these projects conducted when they're funded with government money.
Right, and so what happened is that Governor Rick Scott took office, and originally he was supposed to get about $2 billion in stimulus funds when the Obama administration had really tried to push this high-speed rail effort and was really trying to provide stimulus money to states across the country to really incentivize this process and the building of infrastructure, including train lines. And Governor Scott basically rejected this plan, which was supported by people in his party, the Republican Party, and Democrats alike. He was very worried that it was going to end up falling on taxpayers if the project didn't turn out great. So he obviously exercised his judgment there, shut it down, and then, you know, intentionally or not, perhaps just kind of by pure coincidence, that did create a void there where there was a sense that, you know, maybe somebody else could come in and build a train line that is similar and just wouldn't take state or federal money, and then enter Allboro, Florida, which is this project that is privately financed. Now, there is some federal funding for it, and there is this project by which there is a kind of quasi-governmental agency. This kind of it's a state authorized nonprofit board that is issuing, approving bonds that the will kind of go to finance this, and they're tax exempt bonds. So again, technically the state is not supporting the project, but it is kind of indirectly. And so what you now have is this kind of this project has the support of all these local government officials, and the train is near to completion. It looks like next year is supposedly when it's going to pull out of the station for the first time.
What sort of response did you get from this particular piece? From other maybe Florida politicians, community activists?
It's very interesting. There's a strong divide on this train, and so there's a feeling that in some areas, so the train stops, goes from Miami to Orlando with two stops in between, and so the feeling is that in the four places where there are stops, this could actually have a real nice economic benefit. And it's important to note that Fortress kind of, you know, very well could benefit either way because they own the freight train that uses this rail as well. So they're not only owning the commuter, soon-to-be passenger rail, I should call it, but also they own the freight rail. So the kind of upgrades to the track are going to benefit them either way. But what you kind of got a response, we had this response that was very interesting where you had people who love it and think it's the greatest thing and it's going to provide this crucial service. And then, you have people who are not getting a stop in their town who are basically like, wait, so you're telling me that 16 additional trains, one way, 32 round trip every day, coming through my backyard, and I don't even get a stop. Hmm. And in some cases, these are towns that are very economically disadvantaged. A colleague of mine who helped me write the story, Jessica Silver Greenberg. She was she went to Gifford, Florida, which is one of the poorest areas in this country, certainly in the state of Florida. And what was so concerning to some of these residents is this track is dividing, it kind of splits the town in half in some ways. And so to get access to the hospital, to get access to different needed crucial services, you have to cross that track. And there's a concern that 32 additional trains a day are going to deprive them of that access. And so there's a feeling of being literally left behind by this train, but also kind of being potentially endangered by this train. Obviously, the flip side is, for those towns that get the stop, they feel like there's a real economic benefit, and people might really benefit from, right now there's an Amtrak train, but it's, infrequent and not as quick. So some people feel that there's a real benefit here.
When is this train supposed to begin offering service?
It's supposed to begin next year. Huh. There's been delays in the past, and a lot of it becomes a question then of how do they finance themselves, and I think that there's kind of a remaining, question looming over this company is, can it make money, and how is it going to finance itself on a daily basis? And it really needs these tax-exempt bonds potentially to do it, but they've tried to go to the market and see if investors will buy these bonds, and it's seen as too risky of an investment, so it's demanding too high of an interest rate, and what you end up seeing is right now these bonds are on hold for now.
And when you have a project like this, this massive high-speed rail project in Florida that is being funded by Fortress, so who makes the fee decisions, for example, the daily decisions where people actually ride the train? Is it Fortress or is it the state of Florida?
No, that's a good question. So it is a private, institution, so it is not the state of Florida. The state of Florida has a role in providing regulatory approval and, for various things that needed to happen along the path of the train. And there was this kind of indirect support with the issuance of the bonds, but really it's up to the private company. So it is Fortress in consultation with the company. So Fortress owns All Aboard Florida. So at the end of the day, All Aboard Florida makes these decisions and Fortress in conjunction with it.
Fortress, according to your reporting, was co-founded by Wesley Edens, a former Lehman Brothers partner. Is it safe to assume that most of these private equity firms are run by former Wall Street bankers?
A lot of them, for sure. So, the head of Apollo is former, Drexel, banker. A lot of these guys so you mentioned Wes Edens, the head of Fortress. He, back at Lehman, he was involved in buying up troubled mortgages and the savings and loan crisis. We're talking, kind of a generation ago almost. And so, what you've seen him, it's kind of come full circle now. He's now back in the mortgage business through some of the companies he owns at Fortress. And so these guys, typically take their pedigree from banking and kind of parlay it into a great career in private equity where, there's less scrutiny, there's less oversight, and quite frankly, there's a lot better compensation in private equity than in banking. These guys are paid much better than the bankers.
Ben Protes is an investigative business reporter with the New York Times and one of the reporters investigating the rise of private equity firms. It's a $4.3 trillion industry. They are now running, as you just heard, transportation, water supplies, fire departments, ambulance centers, and their investors expect a 15 to 25% return. So what are your thoughts on this? What do you think about private equity firms providing crucial social services? If you work for local government, what do you think about this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Tucker in Mill Valley. Hi, Tucker. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, thank you. Just basically a sort of comment, but I would love to hear what you have to say, sir. There's a whole political spectrum out there that says we have to return to local control, states' rights and all that sort of thing. How does a local government justify retaining an organization like Fortress or the other that you mentioned earlier as not maintaining local control? Because obviously these people are national. They have absolutely no interest in local control.
Hmm. Yeah, what about that, Ben?
It's interesting. I mean, I think that they try to build up a local, effort. So what you see them do is they do a lot of, political fundraisers on the local level, not speaking in particular to any one firm, but a lot of firms. And they try to have a local presence. They try to give the impression that it is, kind of they're your neighbor. They employ people locally. So they are your boss. They're your neighbor. They're in your backyard. And so it's supposed to be kind of a friendly approach. And that, kind of gets around the perception that it's actually just a private equity firm based in New York or wherever that has a national perspective. I think kind of, for justification purposes, I think some of these towns truly feel like they have no choice. I think some of these towns feel like they need support, they need kind of some reinforcements, and the only way to do that is to rely on a private firm to do it. The question is, certainly privatization is not new in this country. You may support it, you may not support it, it doesn't matter. The question is, when it comes to a crucial service that used to be provided by a bank or a government, should it be private equity that is now owning these private companies? And that's kind of the realm of our series.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Tucker. We've got a number of emails. Thomas in Berkeley says, it's horrifying to hear a 15 to 25% private equity firm. Well, that's what the investors expect back, 15 to 25%. Private equity firms running fire departments, ambulance services, and other public safety agencies formerly run by a city. That's too much profit. No wonder they're endangering the public. I don't think we should allow private equity firms to buy up chunks of California real estate. How will folks purchase a new home if the equity firm has taken available stock out of the market? He goes on to say, I was a public servant with a BS engineering and civil engineering from UC Berkeley, working for the state of California's Department of Transportation as a transportation engineer, and I did excellent work. UC Berkeley trained me well. Firemen and women usually need a BA or a BS from an accredited university, such as the fire captain in Pleasanton, who started out at the bottom and worked his way up. I think similar cities require professional civil servants, need appropriate education. We're actually getting a lot of emails defending people who work for the government. Joyce writes, since the sellout of the country was sold to us as privatization, I wonder why you're now renaming the fraud as private equity. Why is anyone surprised by the outcomes? This was all forecast and objected at the beginning of the promotion of privatization. Well, that's what they call themselves, right, Ben? Where did this term private equity firm come from?
Well, it's very funny because now it's kind of a little bit of a misnomer in the sense that about six or seven of these, the biggest private equity firms, are public. So it kind of doesn't quite work anymore. The main origin of this, keep in mind, is that it's you and I cannot go in and invest in a private equity firm. So the idea is that these firms raise money from their, you know, limited partners, basically, that are pension funds. And so, you know, kind of pension funds or wherever kind of invest some wealthy individuals, but you have to have $1 million net worth or over. And so basically, you know, the idea is that this was private capital, private money that was raised, and then they created these funds within there that invested in different companies. What we've seen, though, in the last, since the financial crisis, is that several of these guys have become publicly traded. Their stock is publicly traded, so you can now, you know, buy a share of Blackstone or buy a share of Carlyle. And these are companies that, but, you know, it's right there in their name, private, but it's kind of become this, there's public perspective for them.
And we talked a little bit about the revolving door. You now have people like former U.S. Secretary, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. He's president of the private security firm Warburg Pincus. And you also write about Springleaf Financial Services, a huge provider of subprime loans in Arizona. It's controlled by the Fortress Investment Group, another huge private equity firm. You report that in Arizona, the Springleaf Financial Services has such a close relationship with lawmakers. One official wrote to a representative, quote, if there's a specific statute that you want to mirror, please tell me the statute number. Thank you so much. So,
right.
I mean,
from that particular email we got from a records request, like a FOIA, that basically was an email from a government official, somebody who's writing the bill to the lobbyist, was saying, you know, what it, basically, tell me what you want to say in the bill, and we'll do it for you. And that's essentially what we saw in several states, you know, as we reviewed these emails.
And, I mean, who's keeping track of this? I mean, it's great that the New York Times, that you all did this amazing investigation. Is this also coming out at the state and local level in the media?
There's some great reporters at in state houses, you know, around the country. I think that, you know, certainly I think that there are plenty of, you know, investigative efforts being done in those areas. What I would say is that obviously there are resources, you know, resource constraints at a lot of these institutions, a lot of these papers, and they're also required to cover, you know, the daily news, you know, that happens in these state capitals. We have, thankfully, the benefit of our editors who are kind enough to let us take the time to, you know, really get into what is going on in not just in Albany here in New York, but, you know, in Phoenix, in Colorado. We looked in, you know, California. There's a bill kind of currently along the lines that Springleaf is pushing. And so our investigative efforts span the country, which is a rare luxury to have.
And at the end of the day, I mean, people's lives are really at risk here. I mean, you've got stories of these ambulance companies that have to raid hospitals because they don't have enough supplies. You've got stories of people needing emergency services, and the people are showing up late, people calling 911 and not getting a response. In fact, one of your leads to one of these pieces, a Tennessee woman slipped into a coma and died after an ambulance company took so long to assemble a crew that one worker had time for a cigarette break. Paramedics in New York had to covertly swipe medical supplies from a hospital to restock their depleted ambulances after emergency runs. I mean, we're talking about people's lives here.
People's lives. And so I think at the very basic level, what our series does is it raises a question about accountability, and all this power and profit has shifted across the financial landscape from banks to private equity. It's worth examining all of that transfer. I think at the maximum level, it's what you just read. It's that people's lives are at stake, and we need to examine whether or not this is a fair thing that's happened. And, you know, when you really look at it, when you look at kind of people's lives, and you think about somebody who died in this, in the particular instance that you were just reading, it took quite a while for that person's ambulance to arrive. And in fact, so long that one of the people on that crew, one of the employees on that crew, had time for a cigarette break. And so this is. You know, because it wasn't adequately staffed, there weren't enough people there. And that employee, by the way, has since sued her own company, her own former company, and basically, you know, accused the former company of leading to this person's death potentially because they weren't adequately staffed. So I think the question becomes, you know, if you have this transfer, are you going to do it well, or are you going to do it in a way that potentially puts people's lives at risk?
So, you know, the next question, Ben, is what can we expect government to actually do about this? I mean, we've got people now in power who hate government, right, especially at the state level, which doesn't really bode well for people who expect basic services. So you've got that. And then when you look back at the housing crisis, so many people came forward from places like Citigroup and said, this is what was happening in my corporation at the very top levels, and the government did nothing. I just watched The Big Short, which I hope everybody could watch that film before we do our show about the housing crisis on Wednesday. And it shows that the government did nothing to protect the people. So in this case, are you hearing from politicians? Or are we going to see changes?
Well, I would actually say not only did the federal government do nothing to prevent this transfer to private equity from happening, they actually enabled it and encouraged it. So in the case of the housing market, what we saw, my colleagues Rachel Abrams and Matt Goldstein, who worked with me on the housing story we did, you know, basically pulled all this data together that shows that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development have sold, you know, over 100,000, you know, troubled mortgages to these private equity firms. And the idea is that the government, it was on the government's balance sheet, they, you know, there was this risk that was to taxpayers. And so the answer was, okay, we got to get rid of it. So who wants to buy it? Well, the only one who could buy it in huge bulk was people who had the money to do that was private equity firms. So they did this, and there was this transfer to them, but, you know, kind of did that come at the expense of consumers? That's a reasonable question to ask. And so I think that, you know, what we've heard since the series ran is that there is some rethinking of this a little bit. And so HUD has just put out a new proposal to perhaps rein that in and to kind of make its asset sales a little more fair, and such that nonprofits and others can bid, not just private equity firms. We've also heard from some people on the Hill, Capitol Hill, who kind of believe that there was an effort recently to deregulate one piece of private equity. There is some regulation of the industry, and there's a bill moving forward that would deregulate part of the industry, supported by the private equity lobby. And after our series ran, we did hear from some people on the Hill that that effort is kind of stalled now. So I think that there is some reconsidering of kind of this movement and the risks that come with it. Whether or not anything massively changes, you know, we'll just have to see.
Well, the pieces are incredible, and huge respect to you and your colleagues at the New York Times for doing this investigation. Ben Protes is an investigative business reporter with the Times. Find their package of stories, Bottom Line Nation, at yourcallradio.org. Ben, thank you for your reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss how the history and experiences of people with disabilities should be taught in California schools. Last month, California announced a new framework for teaching more inclusive history and social sciences. This includes the history of people with disabilities, which is often missing from students' lessons or is framed in a charity or medical model. So what would be a more empowering and inspiring disability curriculum? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.